Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast. I am kind of a host. I really don't do much anymore because I've got Mark Pearson and Chuck Utzwiller here. And today we're going to be talking about media hype. It's just like disasters. They come in threes. Now, I've seen this presentation, Chuck, as you sent this to me ahead of time. I'm really excited about what you guys are going to talk about today because this is the level of paradigm shift if people are truly going to have clarity that they need to understand what's going on. So, Chuck, I'm going to turn it over to you, brother. Take it away.
Matt, thanks for the great introduction, as always. And Mark, great to be with both of you. I'm really excited about this podcast as well. We've all heard the term bad things or disasters happen in three, maybe even back in the day when we had more commercial airline crashes, three crashes that would happen simultaneously or within a week's time. It's kind of a saying that's gravitated over the years. And I thought it was kind of neat that we would add this into our discussion here about the media and just their insatiable appetite, number one, to create fear. I think that's equating to creating eyeballs. But I wanted to talk specifically today, and Mark's got some great commentary on the three big media hypes coming into this year, which actually caused investors to get gravely underweighted in equities. Some even asset managers came in this year shorting the market. So I wanted to talk about each one of those, Mark, each one of the threes. I'll start off with the first one, which almost seems like it was quite a long time ago. It was a few months ago. The famed debt ceiling debate, the government showdown, if you will, between the two parties. And we have always been suspect of conflating what I would call Washington, D.C. and the political environment with owning businesses. And I want you to speak of that just from a specific standpoint, Mark, and I'll lead you into this if it's okay. We see people, probably the number one question we get all the time is, what about the national debt? What about the mismanagement of the coffers from the federal government? The two sides can't agree on anything. And people conflate that with, oh my goodness, that's going to ruin my 401k account. And they get caught into this whipsaw of the commercials that come on that speak to, no, you don't want to own stock because as the government mismanages their finances, that must mean that companies are doing so. So if you would speak to that, I know we've done this before, but please put it in light of this year and how people just exited stage left because they thought we were going to default on our debt.
Well, it's been an interesting year. It is probably the one time in the 27, 28 years I've been managing portfolios that I've heard more people come on TV and say, Well, we really missed this one. This is why we always say you don't invest in the market. You invest in businesses. And volatility creates the opportunity to continue to invest in great businesses. And the reason why that is so important is because it takes you out of a psychological mindset of trying to time investments. It is time in an investment, not timing an investment. And a great example of that is PetIQ, which we've owned for probably four years. And that stock has gone from the 50s at one point all the way down into the sixes. And we loaded up and it's now at 19 to 20. And it's all of a sudden one of our largest holdings 4 years later. It's the ability to strategically continue invest in a great business over time. And the mentality of Wall Street and the mentality of many investors and pros is that their mindset is that you invest, quote unquote, in the market. And the reality is no one is smart enough to know when an economy is actually going to expand and when it's going to contract. So you have to take the timing premise out of the equation. And so when you look at excuses like, you know, we're going to default on our debt, the recession obsession, and the bank failures. There's been plenty to talk about from a negative perspective this year. And in the meantime, as we do this podcast, indexes are about 3 to 4% off their highs. And I would tell you, Chuck, that I'm surprised at how the NASDAQ has performed this year. Even with the Magnificent Seven we've talked about, I'm surprised at how the market has performed this year on the NASDAQ and the valuation metrics. And even though I'm surprised, I still didn't exit. I still stayed invested in the businesses we own and bought more of those businesses when they went down last year. And our clients have significantly benefited from what's happened this year. That means that no matter what kind of noise, what kind of hype people are going to give you, asset allocation is still ultimately the most important aspect while owning great businesses at the same time.
So very well said, Mark. And it is amazing to me, as you just said, when you listen to the prognosticators, let's call them, how negative they were coming into this year, and almost blinded, like you said, by the noise. And I mean,
my golly, the same thing. I'm going to get on the soapbox. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, I want you to. Go ahead.
Stupid stuff. They all repeat themselves. It's like, why do they bring these people on? They all say the same thing. Bring somebody on who thinks outside the box. Bring people on that actually talk about the idea of fundamental investing and continually investing in businesses over time. You know, bring somebody on like a Warren Buffett who talks about, don't listen to all this freaking noise. Know what you own and why you own it. Invest in a great business and hope it goes down 50% so you can buy more of that great business over time. And it's time. In an investment, not timing the investment.
And how much of that focus on timing does the media just foster? They repeat it over and over and over again.
Well, it's because it's what gets people to turn their eyeballs onto the TV, which sells advertising. I don't know if people really understand fundamentally that these news channels are in business to make money. They make money by selling advertising. And in order to sell advertising, you got to get the eyeballs on the screen. And everybody loves to be a prognosticator, postulator, and speculator. And I always love the ones, there are a few of them, you know, in particular, always come on and go, you know, we did the stuff that's worked, right? You know, we said this and we said that back 6 months ago. Nobody questions them and nobody goes back. And I listen to some of these clocks and I'm like, they are so full of crap. It's unbelievable. Anyway, sorry.
I'm so glad that you said that. Well, here's what I'm going to do. You know, man, I'm going to wrap up this first one, this debt ceiling showdown. I want to read
what debt ceiling.
Yeah, right. What debt ceiling? That's what I like. What's a debt ceiling, right? Yeah. I want to read just snippets of this article that was published in the Wall Street Journal. Nobody referenced this on any of the business channels because of what you just said. It wouldn't create the fervor because it's logical. So let me just read it. It says, default on U.S. debt is impossible. Now, nothing's impossible. They maybe should have said improbable, but whatever. Here's what I want to just read. The Constitution makes it clear that bondholders have to be paid and other obligations are debt. So what does that mean? The article goes on. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it says the U.S. really can't default on its debt. First of all, it's constitutional. And they cite Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, saying that it's unequivocal. Then they go on to talk about how the Supreme Court held this to be true back in 1935. And in essence, it says if we ever renege on an interest payment, or we just simply say we can't pay our creditors, the creditor, whoever it is, a person, an entity, another government, has the right to immediately say to the U.S. government, sell this asset and give me the proceeds. That was never said to anybody through this, right? They just let the story go on and they attacked it from every angle except for the truth. So how do you like that, Mark?
Well, what do you think the federal government would do instead of default? They would print more money. And then what happens? Inflation. But fear and greed sell. And that is why clarity is so important. This is why we always say, you don't invest in the stock market. You invest in businesses. The stock market is nothing more than the greatest tool ever created to bring buyers and sellers of businesses together. And people have the opportunity to invest in great businesses through the stock market. So people get so enamored by the noise that they lose focus on what is important. And shockingly, right now, these companies are coming out with earnings and the world has not fallen apart.
No, it's not.
We haven't gone into a real recession and the economy is not really slowing down and this. We will have a recession eventually. We will have a slowing economy. But guess what? That's why you asset allocate, and that's why you sell winners to buy more of the losers on sale, and you strategically cost average in businesses over time.
Well said, my friend. Let's get to disaster number two that never really ended up being a disaster. And I want to lead you into two things here. So it was the so-called bank crisis, right? First of all, a crisis based on three bank failures does not equate, at least in my mind. But let's just kind of walk through this period of time here. So on March 10th of this year, Silicon Valley Bank fails, right? And we know that there's a asset liability mismatch there. There's some other things. They really didn't even have a risk manager. Then we had two other bank failures, Signature Bank. We had First Republic. They were larger banks, but we had three. So immediately, what the media started to focus on was the fact that, oh my goodness, three bank failures leads to 300 bank failures. That must mean that the Fed is not going to raise rates anymore because they caused this disaster to occur. And I remember you talking in our investment committee because we own financials, but we own insurance companies. I want you to talk about those. But then I want you to mention what your comment was about banks in general. It's not that banks are at peril of failing, but here's the issue that you said. They're going to have the regulatory noose wrapped around their neck even tighter due to the fact that we had just this blip on the radar screen. So what do the federal regulators do, Mark, always? They come to the fire after the place has been burned down, right? And what they do is they make stricter regulations. Right. So banks in general, just a general comment, are going to have that expense.
After the building's burned down, you got to put in that fire extinguisher and fire alarm.
Exactly. You got it. So yeah, that's exactly what they do. So speak to, we own financials, we own insurance businesses, but how they're different than banks and why banks are just a tough business to own because of the tightened regulations of the crisis that never happened. Yeah.
So banks are more and more turning into utilities.
Yes.
So they're becoming anti-growth and they're becoming more. What makes the Federal Reserve and what makes the regulators happy is bank stability. The way you bring bank stability is by making it more like a utility. And you don't promote growth, you promote stability, which means from an investment standpoint, then they're only going to become dividend stocks. Insurance companies are a little different. Most people don't realize insurance companies, when you have a major catastrophe, they have the reserves to cover the catastrophe, and sure, the stocks always go down. But the reality is the insurance company ends up making more money because they raise rates and everything else. It's all about risk management. Sure. And so banks, in my opinion, become very, very difficult to own because they do have regulators really trying to force them into a position of becoming, a utility.
Utility.
Yeah.
And they were obsessed, which is called in the media, the financial media, with, okay, when's it time to maybe get in and buy a bank on the dip? And it's this, again, this trading mentality. Sure, you may be able to buy a bank that went from 30 down to 9. You buy it at 9, you're going to sell it at whatever, 15, whatever you're. But that's not us, right? That's not owning a business longer term. It's taking advantage just of a trade.
Right. Well, like every other crisis that I've seen since I've been in this business, including the financial crisis, including 9/11, including COVID, including the bank crisis this year, including all the recessions, including the Asian contagion, including the Russian ruble collapse, including the Mexican peso collapse. And am I missing any of them in here?
The only other one is one of your famous ones is the Fukushima meltdown due to the earthquake in Japan, right?
And the
Fukushima,
the big earthquake and the tsunami. There were two tsunamis.
Tsunami, yes.
Yeah. All of these things that happened, and here we are in the middle of the year talking about the S&P being near all-time highs. This gets back to the fundamental premise that great businesses adjust in periods of downturn and prepare for the next leg of growth. And this is why strategic cost averaging is so important. I think I got in the business. I remember in 1995, when I actually started Nepsis, they were celebrating the Dow hitting 5,000. I remember in 1987, when I was getting licensed originally, I think the Dow was at around 700 or 1,000, somewhere in there.
Well, the Dow just
now I at know 33 or 34,000 on the Dow. I mean, you know, hey, all these people who are asleep at the wheel and they're still trying to guess what bond rates are going to do. They're still trying to guess what the stock market is going to do. And people always ask me, what's your opinion of what the S&P is going to do by the end of the year? And I say, here's my opinion. I don't give my opinion. I'm not in the business of opinions. I'm in the business of investing.
Absolutely. So let's get to the one I know that really raises your ire, the last of the three disasters. We've called it recession obsession. Now, Mark and I speak numerous times throughout the day. Remember that text that I sent you? I think it was CNBC, and they had the tagline going below the speaker, recession obsession. So, yeah.
And we're going to have it until 2025. We're going to have it until we have a freaking recession.
Exactly.
So why don't we just get it done with and move on, please? I'm so tired. I mean, we hear about recession, Tesla, and Disney. That's all we hear about now these days.
Oh, gosh, it beautiful.
How about companies that are hitting all-time highs and new highs instead of the same old stocks?
Well, how about this? I'm going to tee this whole recession obsession things up. I'll take a couple of minutes to give the definitions for our listeners, and then I want you to just kind of to wrap it up, if you will, here. So I think, at least in my estimation, Mark and Matt, that the term recession, because it's so murky and has several definitions, it gives leeway to the media to just drop it. And it's almost like a bomb that drops whenever we hear it, or kind of the hair in the back of our neck begins to rise and we feel queasy. And it part of the reason also, I believe it, because it's been used very much in the political realm where you point fingers
overused
at the opponent. Oh my goodness, we're in recession. And people don't even know what it means. So let me just set the table here. So there's two definitions. The academic definition of a recession is when you have 6 months in a row of, which is call it economic contraction. You use that word. It's the correct word. It means that the economy has slowed, that for 6 months we produced more. That's what gross domestic product is, the outlay of all goods and services, than we did the previous month. And when that happens for 6 months in a row, it's an academic definition of recession. Well, that's not what our industry uses. They use a very different set of data points. And here's the thing, Mark, which is amazing. There's this group in Cambridge, Mass. They're called the National Bureau of Economic Research, the NBER. They're non-governmental. They're a think tank of former Fed officials, PhDs in economics. And they sit on, you're going to love this, a committee called the Dating Cycle Committee. So you got a bunch of Fed officials and nerdy economists on a dating committee. You got to like that, right?
Yep.
And here's what they do. They simply say, okay, we're going to write a paper and we're going to publish this paper. And I'm making this up, but they'll say in May of 2022, the economy entered into a period of contraction because of, and then they'll name four or five arbitrary data points. And then they'll say, oh, by the way, in November of 2022, we exited that period of economic contraction. We've entered into a new economic expansion cycle. They don't even use the word recession.
Oh, I have a headache.
And sometimes this is a year after the fact. So yep. Talk about this term about whistling by the graveyard, climbing the wall of worry. When everyone fixates on disasters that are going to happen, they lure their clients into getting underweight stocks or getting out of the equities altogether. And what our process is, and I know you've talked about this, but this is so key of what we were doing during these so-called disasters versus what other people have. And here's the last thing that I want you to say on. When people get behind, what happens? They jump back in and they buy what looks to have been really appealing. They buy past returns. They push the rest of the market up. And what do the smart people do when those prices of those businesses get elevated? They tend to trim them back. So take that, if you will, and run with it, please.
Well, first of all, stock markets move about 9 months ahead of a recession actually even happening.
Yep.
So the prognostication, postulation, speculation is an element of risk to a portfolio that people are not able to necessarily gauge. And the reality of it is that the process of strategic cost averaging, the process of clarity of understanding the actual businesses you own in your portfolio, and the ability to go buy more of that business when the long-term fundamentals haven't changed, but the value of the business has gone down in price. These processes are what eliminate the need to guess. They eliminate the need to guess.
Exactly.
And if you want to be a successful investor, don't guess. Eliminate the need to guess. And strategic cost averaging and investing with clarity are the ways to do that. Now, people are emotional. We are emotional humans. We talked about this when we talked about AI. AI will never fully take over the investment management process or financial planning process because we as humans are built to be emotional. And we are built to make decisions many times emotionally. But when it comes to investing, you can't. The only emotional aspect of investing you should really think about is, well, I don't want to invest in this sector or that sector because I don't like that sector or believe in that sector. So the ability to know what you own and why you own it becomes important there. But after that, emotions should be left off the table. The process of your investing should be what you stick to. And the process should be based upon your investment philosophy and strategy, flexibility and transparency.
Totally eliminating, right, any dependency on media. Correct. Commercials.
Correct.
Buy this DVD, buy the next Harry Dent book, whatever. Correct. It is. It eliminates. Correct. It. And it's why you said better wealth, better life, why clarity just in general frees you up from fear and from all aspects. It's
exactly. Exactly.
All right, Matt, I'm going to pass it back to you to close us out here. And thanks so much for having us again.
Absolutely. So my summary is going to be very brief, but quite pointed. As Mark and Chuck both said, everybody, media just wants your eyeballs. So they're going to say the same things that are tried and true and proven, regardless if they're applicable or not. Like the three stocks that Mark was talking about, and the fact that there's all this recession obsession and national debt and all. They know that these are your hot buttons, so they're going to continue to push those buttons.
Absolutely.
This is why you need clarity on knowing what you own and why you own it in your portfolio, which is where most people fall down with their financial services relationship. People are still trying to say and sell you the same thing that they've been selling, just like the media, scare tactics, fear, and stuff that has actually been disproven to even work 20, 30 years ago. So if you want to know a little bit more, just please go to nepsis.com. Mark, is there any other places they should reach out?
Well, nepsisinc.com. You probably slipped. Yeah, it's nepsisinc.com. Download our app. We have an app. You can get updated on the podcast and other social media things that are going on for Nepsis. Otherwise, the website is a great place to go. NepsisInc.com.
NepsisInc.com. For Mark and Chuck, this is Matt Halloran, and we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor.